And it's about time for true crime. Hi.
Hey, guys.
How are you?
How are you doing?
We are fabulous.
Are we?
Well,
one of us is doing better. Hi, I'm feeling good.
Hi, I have an ulcer.
It's not funny.
It's a little funny.
It is hilarious that she goes, ouchie, my tum-tum, and then goes to the doctor and they're like, that's an ulcer, ma'am. You need to calm down.
I went to the doctor and I said, wait, what is that? And she goes, oh, it's just going to eat a hole in your stomach lining. Don't stress. I was like, yeah, okay.
You know what?
For sure.
I'm cured, actually. Now that you mention it, I should stress less. Actually.
I got to go cancel my psychiatrist appointment. I'm all better, babe. So that's where we're at. That's a fun little update for you.
It's so ironic that being told that there's a hole in your stomach lining and it's going to get worse if you don't stop is like one of the more stressful things you could be told.
It's like, oh, no, okay. Yeah, no, this doesn't bother me at all.
But other than that, things are great.
Other than that, things are so good.
So good.
Yes. And I did not just almost burst into song. Nope. But I didn't.
No.
So there's that.
Baseball season's coming up. We're not there yet.
It sure is. I am really excited. I actually, by the time this comes out, I will have already been to a baseball game this year.
Okay.
We're going to the opening game for the Cubs.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll be fun. I mean, as long as I can eat a hot dog without my stomach burning, it'll be great.
So, okay, is this like a Portillo's hot dog? Is that what this is mostly like?
Oh my God. Wait. Why are you even taking me there right now? I love it.
I'm asking. I don't know.
No, it's not at the ball games. At the ball games, it's not quite the same.
I'm not a Midwesterner. I don't know.
Don't get me wrong. A ball game dog is a great dog, but it is not like a Portillo's dog. Portillo's dog is like its own thing.
Okay.
It's beauty. It's grace. It's Miss Midwestern States. Mm-hmm. It's everything.
Okay.
But it's too good for a ball game hot dog. A ball game hot dog is elevated by the scenery, not by
the quality,
the hot dog of it all.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, fun fact, I've never been to a professional baseball game.
Oh.
I've been to like minor league stuff.
Yeah.
But I've never gone to like a Red Sox game.
Mm.
Mostly because I don't really care.
That's the thing about baseball. I'm so sorry if you do care. I don't care at all. It's in fact pretty boring to watch on TV, but going to a game is fun because like you're at the game.
I mean, I think the music would be fun and hanging out with your friends would be fun. Mm-hmm. And like, I just want everyone to have fun. You know, like I want both teams to win, you know, like I don't care enough that I'm like, well, they're having fun. They're making more in, you know, this year than I'm going to make in my life. I
mean, oh, for sure.
And I just helped them do it by buying them a ticket.
Yay. Go
Yay.
Team.
Woohoo.
Yeah. My response normally when people ask me who I'm rooting for is whoever wins.
That's the one. I called it. I knew it. I always knew that about
them. They were mine.
Yeah.
I was rooting the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But I like going. The atmosphere of like going to sports is fun. Have you ever been to a hockey game?
Not a professional one, but I will say, so I used to go all the time in college. I loved going to college hockey games. It was so fun.
College hockey games are fun. And I didn't even know that. I mean, like, I went to school in the Northeast. So, like, it's pretty normal out here. I don't think I heard a lot about hockey being a sport that colleges really advertised in the Midwest. But
no, it's a big deal. It's
a big deal out here. I loved our women's hockey team, but I do really enjoy going to see the Bruins because there's just really something special in my heart about like men beating each other up on ice, you know?
Yeah, it's the on ice of it all.
Yeah, it really is. And like, I like to pretend I know what's going on. I can't skate like that. I can't even move like that. And they're doing a sport on top of moving. So I have respect for it. But there is something really fun about just being like, yay, hit him with the chair. You know?
There's something so fun about that. I love that you have to bundle up because you like to bundle. I don't want to be cold, but I want to be bundled. You know what I mean? But I could care less about basketball.
Yeah.
I just, the sound of the sneakers on the squeaky. I don't love it. And I've also like, I don't know if you're new here, but Abby makes fun of this all of the time. I am quite short. I come in at a whopping around five feet tall. And basketball, like when I had to play in school, I was like, why am I here? Yeah. Why am I here? You could just literally stand over me. You could palm my face.
No, you're there for the tag team plays where they lift you up and then you dunk.
And I'd still mess it up because it's me. So I just have like bad memories of basketball where like I can't do it. It wasn't meant for me. It wasn't meant for people like me.
I don't like going because it's too squeaky for my little neurodivergent brain.
Yeah, it's like overstimulating.
Yes, but I do like playing basketball this summer recently. I actually got pretty good at it.
You did not, did you? Really?
I actually did. It was as like part of my job. We would do things in parks.
Mm-hmm.
And so there would always be like a basketball round or two. So you know how many games of like around the world and hog I play, or not hog, horse?
Horse? Yeah, you played hog real good.
Yeah, sure did. No. But I was surprised. I was like, oh my God, look at me go. And then there's like, you know, little kids whooping my ass at basketball. But I'm like, oh my God, I got one.
If nobody tries to get the ball away from me,
mm-hmm.
and I get to stand as close as I want,
mm-hmm.
and no one watches me and I don't feel pressured,
mm-hmm.
I might get it in 1 in 5.
That's hot.
Yeah. That's fucking, that's 20%.
And that's better than 0.
It is.
And
so,
better than 10.
You know what? I'm going to take the win when I get it. And I'm going to be the one that's like, does anybody need waters? Yeah. On the side.
Oh my gosh. You're going to be the water boy?
Yeah. I'm the mom friend. Have you had a snack?
Are you mom friend water boy or are you Adam Sandler water boy?
Oh, I'm mom friend water boy.
I know that.
I'm Adam Sandler water boy in every other area of my life.
All right. Well, should we get into part two?
Yeah, we have sad shit to talk about.
I feel like I've made people wait and we really kind of like started amping up what's going on here and then put a pin in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess with that being said, yoo-hoo, pod's on. Hi, hello, and welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast.
Yes.
About time for true crime.
It is.
Somehow. But we today are talking about Charles Sinclair, known as the Coin Shop Killer. We are in part 2 of 2. And just as a fun little reminder, I wanted to give some trigger warnings and a shout out to some of my sources. So for trigger warnings, we do have, again, we're talking about violence and homicide. And there is a mention in this episode of sexual assault, but it is not detailed or graphic, just so you know it is there. And for sources, I wanted to give a shout out, again, a big one to Northern Nightmares. They're an Alaskan-based true crime podcast. It's a mom and a daughter, and they are wonderful. They were so fun to listen to and so well-informed, just very good research. And also, of course, Evil Lives Here, and all of the other ones I have, New York Times, LA Times, etc. It's all linked below. You can go and see that there. But I did just want to give a little wee baby recap of what we talked about last week. We were introduced to Debbie, Charles, Michael, and Pam Sinclair, a family that we are talking about. They are currently moving around the West Coast in like the mid to late 1980s. And Charles, the dad, had a shop where he sold rare and special coins. I guess that's kind of the same thing. And also special,
rare, special, unique, and
and talent.
Yep.
And his shop was so good, it was actually able to expand to have rare and like high-end firearms as well. It was called Shooter Supply. And then one day in 1985, it burned to the ground.
Ruh-roh.
Despite the investigation for arson coming back inconclusive, Charles, Debbie, and the kids went on the lam. They went on the run. And shortly thereafter, as far as we know, Charles started completing what I would call incredibly transactional robberies and murders of other coin and jewelry shops all around the United States to fund his family's lifestyle.
Which just sucks because that could have easily have just been him like 6 months ago.
Truly, truly.
My guy.
It's kind of crazy to me that he went so close to home and not physically. Physically, he went to states away, like he would go as far away as he
right.
thought he needed to, I think, but that he chose to go to other coin and jewelry shops. I'm like, that literally was you.
Talk about shitting where you eat.
Literally. So the family, as far as we know, doesn't know what's happening. Pam did the interview on Eva Lives Here, his daughter, and she basically says that like everything was pretty normal, except that he would leave for quote unquote business trips for a couple of weeks, a few times a year, two or three. And while it was strange that they moved around a lot, and they did move around a lot, it sounds like even when they were in one state, they'd kind of hop around from neighborhood to neighborhood. And even then, they'd move states quite a bit at that. That life was pretty normal. They'd have family dinner together. He was dad. Mom was a stay-at-home mom. The kids went to school. They had friends. And the only other thing that was weird is that the family changed their last name from Sinclair to Weir after they left New Mexico, where Shooter Supply was before it burned down. And the kids were pretty much told that you have to go by this name now or the police are going to frame me for the burning down of the shop, which is a fascinating lie to tell considering there was no active investigation on that. And then if that happened, they would split up the family. So it sounds like the family unit itself was pretty put together. It was just in the midst of Charles' depravity. I guess. Now, we talked about a few different shops and owners that were killed. Charles had kind of a typical MO where he would go find a shop. He'd stake it out for about a week. He'd, you know, watch it during different times of the day, find out when it's the most and the least busy. He'd go in a few times, get to know the employees. And then he'd sort of propose a deal where he either told them he was going to buy or sell like several thousand dollars worth of pieces, whether that was coins or jewelry. Sounds like coins were really his thing. And once he did that, he'd like set up an appointment time, usually for the least busy day and time of the week. And then he'd go in, he would shoot whoever was working, and then he would rob the store blind and walk out like nothing happened. Now, we left off last week on one of the only rare exceptions to this MO in his history that we know of. That was Robert and Dagmar Linton. And the Lintons were a very sweet couple who had been married for like 41 years, got retired, and were going on this long kind of like camping trip where they were driving up the West Coast from California to Vancouver, Canada. They had the misfortune of meeting Charles, and we don't know what happened to them. Their bodies have never been found, but their truck was found with a massive blood stain at the bottom, and their credit card was used for a long time making weird purchases that we talked about, like a crock pot and a clarinet and some men's underwear.
I just always knew him to be musical in my heart of hearts. I pictured him as a horn player, but then I was like, no, woodwind, obviously.
It's so true. He doesn't have the guts for a brass instrument.
No, like, if anything, he might be a trombone player, but he'd be bad at it.
Yeah.
So he's, yeah, you know. Do that one more time. What was that?
No.
Okay.
But...
So he's trying to make purchases that maybe he thinks are normal so as to...
Maybe make throw it, people off the scent. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Like maybe he got valuables from him and that, like from, maybe he got valuables from them when he, I mean, initially I'm assuming like robbed them and murdered them and then maybe just kept using their credit card on things maybe he guessed they might purchase so that it would kind of alleviate any suspicion like, oh, well, they're fine. They're still spending money and traveling and on their merry way. They just, you know, haven't called anybody and left all of their things.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And we'll get there later. But this case in particular, although it was a deviation from what his normal MO was, is really how he gets caught in the long run, because the investigators on this case are so good at it. So invested in seeing justice and closure brought to the Lintons' murder that they are on this shit. Mm-hmm. They convinced credit card companies to keep the credit lines open so that he wouldn't get tipped off with a maxed out credit card. And when they finally found the truck, the reporters around the area got hold of the story. And even though they were asked not to run the story, they did. So it's around that time that the family moves again. and they stay where they're at in, I think they're still in Washington at that time, but they stay there for a little bit. And eventually, one day in the middle of the school year, Charles comes home and says, "That's it. We're moving to Alaska."
Hmm.
And that's where we left off last week. So today we're picking up. It is a random weekend in the middle of the school year. And the Weir Sinclair family is now moving to Alaska. It is 1989 in the summer. So my guess is probably like May or like August. So right at the end or the beginning of the school year.
Mm.
They leave for Alaska out of the blue and they go to Kenny Lake, which is about 80 miles north or around 128, 129 kilometers north of Valdez, Alaska. And while this normally, I mean, yeah, that's kind of a drive, it doesn't sound crazy far. Like you could do that in a day.
Mm-hmm.
Alaska's pretty fucking weird. They don't really have a developed interstate network.
Yeah.
That you can drive on. So it definitely takes a lot longer than that to get there. And if that's not enough, they are in a pretty teeny tiny desolate town. They buy 160 acres of land. And they are in a town that has a mercantile, a hotel, and the hotel has a restaurant.
And that's it.
And that's it. I got three things, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so pretty desolate.
Very isolated and very small. And again, they're on 160 acres, so they
that's
don't
a lot
even
of
have... Yeah, they don't even have neighbors with an earshot.
No, no, no.
But they also don't really have a very luxurious home. They have a lot of land, but they have a tiny cabin that is entirely dry. So there's no running water. There's no plumbing. I think there's insulation in like 2x4s. There's a wood stove and a cook stove, but I don't even think there's electricity. So it's them and the land.
I would think around this time, mm-hmm. if I were one of the kids or the wife, I would start thinking now what the hell is going on? Because having to abruptly move, like, of course you'd be thinking it, but you kind of can return to some kind of normalcy in that. Like,
yeah.
Like you said, like family dinners and like going to school and sports events and like all the things that like, you know, quote unquote normal families do that like, sure, you might move around a lot, but like, hey, maybe you're one of your classmates was like a military kid and,
right.
you know, from a military family and that's normal. And dad works in oil now, apparently, or at least that's what we have to say. So I don't know, maybe this is normal. But then you pack up and leave and you move to somewhere very far away.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, in this area, not a whole lot
nope.
at all. You don't have running water. Like, all right, who, maybe it was on their bucket list that they wanted to shit outside. I don't know. But it's not on mine, personally.
No.
And that has got to be, like, right when you start moving somewhere where you're like, we are alone alone versus, like, we're just living on the outskirts and we move around a lot to being, like, we are alone with our thoughts. We don't have electricity. You're not watching TV. You're not scrolling TikTok. You're not doing any of the
yeah.
things that like you and I would imagine we could do from anywhere, wherever. Like we're talking still 80s, middle of nowhere on like nearly 170 acres
yeah.
of just beautiful nature, I'm sure. But like, what are you doing other than thinking of how you got there?
Well, and that's the thing that is confusing to me is Charles consistently goes multiple states away. Even when they were living in like the lower 48, he's going states and states away. He started in Indiana. He's going places that aren't bordering.
Where he's murdering people, you mean? Yep.
Yes. And so it's fascinating to me that he then decides, okay, now we have to move to Alaska.
Hmm.
Because other than the Lintons, it didn't sound like he really committed any crimes nearby where they lived while they were living there. I know they continued to move around, but not for nothing. The United States isn't like another country where, you know, in Europe you can kind of get from one to another the same way you get from state to state here.
Yep.
It's huge. He could have gone to the other coast. He could have done anything in the middle of the country. Like there's a lot of places to go that don't include shipping your family up through another country or over an ocean. And I went to Alaska. I forced you to listen to me talk about it last time. It's beautiful, but it is you in that land. Like them living off 160 acres. I went to a city in Alaska and had a hard time finding tomatoes in September.
Yeah.
Like it's you and what that land is providing. And that land provides wonderful things. It provides a lot of wildlife, which I think he probably was into hunting. That probably worked out well for them in that way. But other than that, I mean, what are the kids and Debbie going to do? Like Pam and Michael and Debbie are probably just out wandering the fields for something to do.
Yeah,
like I don't think they're going to a school.
I was
going to
say, is there no school around? It's not like you're doing it from home. There's, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like right about now is when if I were any of them, I'd be like, what are we?
What the fuck?
Because all you have is time.
Yeah.
All you have is time. And what are you thinking? You're thinking how you got there.
And what you're going to do when you're there, except what you're going to do when you're there is one of like five things. And it's bringing in the water so you can boil it to take a bath.
Like, mm-hmm. Don't forget shit outside.
Don't forget shit outside. You best be glad that you moved in the summer and not in the winter when it's you and 160 acres of land and Alaskan wilderness.
Yes. Like, and potentially, depending on the time of year and where, no sunlight.
Correct. So just fascinating and kind of an interesting picture to paint of like where they're living and what's going on. It seemed like this was the first time the family really was running low on money, or at least that Debbie let on that she was really worried about money.
Okay.
And so lo and behold, Charles leaves for another trip. And they had only been in Alaska for a little bit when he left. See, he left in late April of 1990, but this trip is different.
Mm-hmm.
This trip, he's planning to be gone for 3 months.
So that's a long time.
That's a long time, especially where his last trips were historically like 10 days to like 3 weeks max.
Right.
And 3 months, again, it's 1990. You're not like calling each other up on your cell phones. So he really had to plan for it to be this long. And the family knew it was going to be that long. So they didn't start freaking out at 4 weeks when they're like, where is he?
Yeah. And who would you call if you were worried?
Right. And so he's planning to leave. I just picture being Debbie and being like, all right, well, it's me and my two kids in Alaskan wilderness while my husband's gone and we have no money. So let's figure that out for however long it's going to be, huh?
Yeah.
Around this time, investigators noticed that Charles started to go dormant during the winters. The latest he'd really commit a crime in the year is about November. And then it sounded like he kind of hunkered down for the winter and like would enjoy the holidays.
Oh, me too.
You know? And then he'd start up again in the spring. So in early May of 1990, Charles continues this trend and he goes to Murray, Utah, or Murray. I don't know how you say it. I'm not from there. You can let me know. But he goes to Utah to the Legacy Rare coin store. Like the others before, he goes a few times the week leading up, charms the workers under the alias of Jim Stockton this time. And he tells everyone that he's a farmer from Texas. And you know what? He's selling his farm and he's coming into some money and he wants to invest that in gold.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But an employee here is like, that's kind of sus because you do not have working man hands. Like your hands are not calloused the way a farmer's would be.
Yeah. You don't have farmer hands.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating that someone was able to suss that out. This employee ultimately doesn't say anything. Like, he doesn't call him out. He doesn't tell his boss or anything. But he's like, yeah, I thought that was pretty weird. Because, like, that's a white-collar hand if I ever did see one.
Well, and it's probably smart that he didn't confront him on it.
Yeah.
A case that I'm working on that you will hear next week. There was some suspicion about somebody not being maybe who they said they were.
Mm-hmm.
And the other person was like, I don't believe you. And that isn't, I mean, you should be able to say that and you should be able to think it and everything. But like the fallout from that can be so much more.
Yes.
consequential than you might have thought. So I kind of give this guy props for like taking note in his head and not being like, well, really? Because I don't think so. Because you don't look like you've held a rake in your life.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. Or like, you don't look like you're driving tractors or anything.
Yeah. So I hear you. I think that's fair. And with Charles, I mean, he was known to be kind of schmoozy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Northern Nightmares said he had kind of like a used car salesman vibe. I think he definitely sounds like someone who would charm the pants off you if he could take them from you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it's got a good frame.
Yeah. So I think that he probably wouldn't have done anything, but it might have thrown him off enough that he could have. And other people certainly have before for calling them out on that. So this employee doesn't say anything. And a few days later, on May 4th, Charles makes his move. The store is near empty, and there's only one other worker there named Kelly Flanagan.
Mm-hmm.
And Kelly is this, what I imagine to be like just a normal guy working at the store. He's like minding the cash register. And Charles comes in and he's like, but I gotta pee.
Mm-hmm.
And Kelly's like, okay, but like the bathroom is supposed to be for only the workers. Like, it's not a public bathroom.
Yes, it's an employee-only bathroom, but
I think he must have gotten comfortable enough with Charles over the week or the last few days that he was like, okay, fine, you can go in.
Mm.
And my guess, now I haven't heard this explicitly said anywhere, but my guess is he probably had to go unlock it or like show Charles where the bathroom was.
Mm-hmm.
Because Charles' response to this was not like, thank you, man, I had a long drive. It was to call Kelly a bastard under his breath and then shoot him in the head with a silenced .22 caliber handgun in the head.
Oh, God.
And now that's awful, but Charles then does what he does and he robs the place blind. Mm. And then he, you know, is a real gentleman and he puts a curtain over Kelly before walking out calmly like nothing happened.
Oh, okay. How sweet.
Yeah, it was. And you know what's crazier? He walks away with $70,000.
70 grand.
Yeah. Or at least the equivalent in the coins and everything he took.
Wow.
That's a hell of a salary to make in a day. And this is 1990.
Poor Kelly.
But wait.
Mm.
Poor Kelly, yes. But Kelly survives.
Oh, thank you. I figured he had to with him hearing Charles mutter.
Yes.
Bastard.
Yeah, that'd be crazy if we just knew that. That'd be funny.
I feel like Charles went and he's like, I've been shitting outside for the last like month. Can I please
use your bathroom? But I am begging you for a toilet that flushes.
And then he's just like, ugh, all right, buddy. And he's like, bastard.
Now down to business. Ugh. But Kelly survived on like the luckiest luck that a man could ever have. Kelly turned his head so slightly at the very last second. And my guess as to why he like had to open the bathroom or show Charles where the bathroom was is because I think he probably heard Charles mutter it and then like turned his head to be like, what was that?
What did you just call me?
What'd you call me? And the 22, typically 22s usually do the most damage because they ricochet wherever they go. So if someone's shot in the head, it would ricochet sort of through their skull and do damage that way.
Yeah, like when people get shot in like the midsection,
mm-hmm.
it's not the initial wound that is likely to kill them with that caliber. It's like it'll bounce around in and cause internal damage.
Yes.
And then if it comes out at all, it does. But it's from that bouncing around that it first does. It's not great.
No, it's pretty bad. But because of the way that Kelly turned his head, this bullet only skimmed around the outside of his skull and then back out of his head.
Wow.
Which is just crazy
to
think about.
That is Matrix style shit.
It is. His skull was literally Keanu Reeves.
That is madness.
And so Kelly did, I think, an amazing job. I don't know if he was unconscious or if he was pretending to be dead that whole time that Charles was robbing the store, but he gets up and out somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And gives an amazing description. He works with a sketch artist and the police are on it.
That's fascinating. And I'm sure that Charles saw all the blood because any injury to the face or like head area bleeds so much that he probably made out better because it was there, and he probably bled a lot, and Charles was like, oh, I got him in the head, like, I'm good, and he moved on.
Right.
Like, he threw whatever he threw over him, robbed the place, and left. And that's probably why Kelly lived.
I think so. And I'm so glad that Kelly lived, because Kelly is also instrumental in catching Charles.
How scary.
So, if you remember, the investigator on the Linton case was really invested. And this is the couple from Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He's super invested. And even though it's been a few years, he holds on and he regularly searches for anyone with the MO of what happened to the Lintons.
Okay.
And the investigator was sure that that wasn't the only time that whoever attacked the Lintons had. So when he heard about Kelly's survival in Utah, it prompted him to reach out to them and be like, hey, I think I have another case that this guy did.
What was the connecting point to him? Like, what was it about the Linton's case and Kelly's case?
So, great question.
Thank you.
The credit card that Charles had stole, before he had stopped using it, he tried to buy a rare gold peso.
That is right.
He did.
Before or after the crock pot? I think this was after.
I think this was after the crock pot. But this is what initially prompted investigators to call the credit line to be like, can you please extend it? Because we need him to not catch on that we know this is happening.
Yes.
But because it was a rare coin, and a rare coin and like a coin interest is...
it's niche.
Niche. Yeah. Like, not a bunch of people have it. And I don't think a lot of people are searching out multiple different rare coin shops, even if you are into it.
Right.
So the fact that this was a robbery and a murder at a rare coin shop prompted this guy to be like, hold on, I think this is our guy.
Good on him. That's great police work.
Amazing investigative work, especially for years to pass for a couple that was literally traveling through your state.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I think that is just such dedication. So he reaches out, and now Washington and Utah investigators are working together. And after this, like, 2 months pass. Again, Charles is on his long trip, so he hasn't been home. He's left Debbie with the kids, which is so rude. But Charles goes to Billings, Montana, where he scopes out the Treasure State Silver and Gold Coin Shop.
Oh, the way I'd go in there?
Girl, I know it.
The way I want to go to Montana. Are you kidding me?
Montana seems beautiful. Oh, my
God. I just want to go out west.
So, at the Treasure State Silver and Gold Coin Shop, Charles does what he's done at this time what feels like a million times before. He goes a week or so, he scopes it out, he talks about making a big buy, and this time his alias is Charles Hortman.
Charles Hortman.
Mm-hmm.
So he went with the same first name.
Yeah.
That seems bold. Why do you keep changing it, man?
I don't know. And
you killed everybody that met you under that name.
Right? You can use Jim Stockton. It's fine. It doesn't get old. It doesn't expire, you know? Mm-hmm. But anyway, curious, because on July 30th, he shoots the 60-year-old owner, Charles Farbo. There's a lot of Charles going on here. So Charles Farbo is the owner.
Okay.
And he is shot in the typical way that our Charles does, with a silenced .22 handgun, and then Charles robs the store. Mm-hmm. While Charles is robbing the store, though, a receptionist walks in not knowing anything happened because his gun was silenced, and Charles then shoots the secretary, shoots the receptionist, and then he goes back and doubles back to Charles Farbo, the owner, and shoots him again.
Oh.
Because he didn't want another, you know, Kelly.
So two people have died in this.
Yes.
Ugh.
He walked away from this robbery with $54,000 worth of goods.
My good God.
So in 3 months, he's made $125,000-ish in 1990.
Wow. Okay.
These are quickly tied to the Utah murder because of the .22 caliber. And the Utah murder was tied to the Linton murder. And this is when they start to learn about the other crimes that Charles has done. So at this point, the FBI is involved. There's a lot of different states going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI, like, obviously starts to want to connect him to other crimes that could be unsolved that are from him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when they hear about the one in Indiana and they learn about Washington and California and all of these other shops that he's hitting up and doing this at.
That all have some kind of connection to coins.
Yes. And that means the manhunt for Charles Sinclair starts in early August of 1990. I want to add here that the FBI also suspected him of a 1980 murder in Southern Washington.
Okay.
This was another coin and jewelry shop, and the owner was David Sutton. It was in January of 1980, and the place was robbed of about $80,000 worth of goods. The issue with it, though, is that it happened in 1980, and while this by no means is impossible, people tend to think that his criminal career started in 1985 when his shop burned down.
Okay.
Now, I don't know how much I believe that, because if his criminal career started with that, he pretty immediately went to Indiana and did this exact thing,
mm-hmm.
where he staked out a place and shot the owner and robbed it. So I would think there's probably some sort of escalation leading up to that where he thought he was capable and could do that without getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than possible that he is behind David Sutton's murder, but there is nothing that we can strongly say connects him to this in a way that I feel comfortable saying, like, I'm putting all my weight behind.
Okay, makes sense.
So, but when I was listening to Northern Nightmares coverage on it, they called it the perfect crime, which just really reminded me of that weird hypothetical that Charles asked Pam at the end of part one,
mm-hmm.
where he was like, do you think there's such a thing? And I almost wonder if he was talking about this.
Oh.
Where, like, everything else he did, he's doing it kind of out of necessity. But in 1980, he had the shop. So it would have been just out of, I don't know, the ability to.
When you're investigating a crime, you're trying to figure out why somebody might have motive to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, a robbery, okay, are they behind on loans? Like, you look at financial history, you look at people who owe debts, you try to find out, I don't know, maybe you have an informant that can tell you about people who owe debts to other people, right. where it's not exactly on the books. Like, you're looking for some kind of, like, reason for somebody to feel the need to do that. And if he's, like, a successful owner and he's got, like, he's a dad of two,
right,
chilling, this isn't going to be your initial thought of, like, yeah, it's him. It's like, he's a fellow store owner whose store's doing fine.
Yes.
Supposedly. You wouldn't think it's him.
Yeah. So it is interesting to me. I do wonder if that was him and that's sort of what he was thinking about, or if there are other prior victims that he has that aren't connected to him.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect there are in some way, shape, or form. I just don't know if they were all murder victims.
Right. I feel like you'd escalate.
Yeah, it's really rare in my experience and from what I've heard, like, learned in, you know, our combined decade of education.
No, I sound so old.
That anybody, like, just starts here and starts on a patterned rampage kind of like this.
Right.
But while this one has some doubt, the rest that I've talked about and that I'm going to talk about, they're very confidently connected to him. Multiple fingerprints have been collected from many of these crime scenes that the FBI is now starting to connect to him, but they didn't match with anyone in a criminal database. Again, this is 1990, so we don't have, like, big lists of people selling bio information or, like, taking from DMV databases even for, like, your face photo. So they're right. really just running it against who they've already arrested. And mm-hmm. Charles had a pretty clean record from what I know of. I don't even think he had a speeding ticket.
Mm.
But a tip comes in about a silver car in Montana that a local had seen right outside of that Treasure State silver and gold store right before the murder of Charles Farbo.
Ruh-roh.
They're able to give a fucking license plate number. I love small towns.
Mm-hmm.
I love them.
Like, he don't belong here.
And whoever called is definitely my kind of person. And yours too. I know you used to like dial weird license plate numbers you saw.
When I was a kid, yeah. If I were walking with my friends and a weird car like went too slow or passed us a few times, I would dial the number and call it because I didn't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
I think it'd be different depending on the year, but and then I was like, well, if I get abducted, at least the last number I called is the license plate number. And I was like 10 years old. So this has been in me since I was a youngin'.
It's innate, babe.
And since I was yay high. And
that's since you were
my exact height right now.
Ankle high to a grasshopper. And now you're knee high. Look at how you've grown.
Oh.
So, again, this doesn't match up with anyone in their database, but they get this license plate number. And police are able to track this car down to an airport in Jacksonville, Wyoming. And they find packaging from the Treasure State Silver and Gold store. They also find the .22 caliber with an attached silencer.
Mm.
And the car itself is registered to Larry Ulrich, which is one of Charles' aliases.
Can't believe he's registering cars in other places.
That means he's like paying for car registration. And I know that he has the stuff to make fake IDs because he already did it. But like, the kind of money you got to be making to have cars in these different places is insane.
Rent one like Jody Arias did.
Yeah, come on.
Just good God.
Go over the state, carry all of your gas, and then claim that you weren't there.
It's and you got easy. Lost and you did a whoopsie for 3 hours, which I've done before, but I didn't kill anybody.
Nope. So they run Larry Ulrich and they find it connected to a license in Washington. And they find that Larry Ulrich of Washington had some kids in a school district.
Mm-hmm.
And the investigators find a principal who remembers the family. The principal tells the investigators that the kids were, you know, pulled out of school really abruptly to move to Alaska.
Hmm.
Isn't that weird? There's nothing else really notable, but that's pretty odd. And the investigators then find a storage unit under, I believe, Larry Ulrich, but certainly one of the aliases, where they find the clarinet that was purchased on the Lintons' credit card, the crock pot, and the pack of underwear.
So they find these items.
Yes, so he didn't even wear the tidy whities.
He didn't need the crock pot?
No.
Sir.
He didn't even make a dump cake with it.
You were sitting on gold, my friend.
Literal and crock pot wise.
And then the clarinet. See, now I want to pick up another instrument
because
I'm a weirdo.
As you should.
Okay. I played saxophone, sold it to a guy in a grocery store parking lot.
As is the way.
I loved it while I had it, but yeah. I was like, am I going to, maybe I'll play it again. I don't know. Have my piano.
Mm-hmm.
Clarinet is on my list, as is violin.
Mm.
So we will see. But you bought a clarinet. You brought this beautiful woodwind.
Yep.
And then you just leave it to rot.
You probably didn't know that you had to soak the reed before starting to play. And he's like, why sounded like shit.
Why does it sound terrible? And yeah. It's like, because you got to suck on it for a little bit. It's true. It's not glamorous, but it's the truth.
And in the storage unit, they also found a shitload of coins. And it was jam-packed with other things, like the materials needed to make fake IDs, other fake IDs, piles of maps. And then get this. Also, C4 explosives and Claymore landmines.
What were you doing?
Right? There is nowhere in any of the crimes he's connected to where explosives and landmines are needed or used.
What was he planning? That's what that makes me think.
Exactly. And while I know that in his previous shop, he had like rare firearms, it doesn't sound like he kept a giant collection of those.
Also, I mean, would he need to be flying with these things? This seems like this would be acquired locally.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You'd think. And the other thing for me that's really frustrating is like, he has all of these rare coins. He has gold. He has silver. He has landmines. He's got firearms. And they're all sitting in a storage unit, which means he could just sell them and not murder and rob people.
Mm.
He could just literally sell what he's sitting on and harm nobody. But okay.
But then the well dries up and apparently he can't handle that.
Yeah, I know. God forbid you get a job, but come on. So they learn that Larry goes to Alaska. And they go to Alaska. And now the hunt is on. But of course, Alaska's fucking big. And it's cold. And it's pretty isolated. Charles goes back to Kenny Lake. And it takes a while. But the FBI finally does like really start to narrow in and track him down. So Charles gets back home on August 1st of 1990. And I just want to repeat, his last hit was on July 30th. So he literally hit up this shop and then went home like the next day.
Yeah, you got to get out of town.
Yeah. And then he's like, honey, I'm home.
And they're like, well, it's been 3 months.
They're like, fucking finally, man. You missed all of summer. The fireweed was beautiful, if you even care. And I bet he didn't. But they're on 160 acres and Charles comes home. He smooches his kids and the wife. He gives Michael, his son, a Rolex.
Here, kid, try to tell time in the dark with it.
This way you can time how long you're in the outhouse.
Yeah, now you can. You want to know what time you took a shit last night? I can tell you.
No, you can tell me. But he gets back and Pam in her interview says that she was kind of like apprehensive at first. I don't know if he was usually tired when he came back from trips or maybe he was paranoid and like a little high anxiety. But
You've just murdered like 10 people for no reason. Yeah, you should be paranoid.
Mm-hmm. But Pam says that he seemed really happy to be home. And for a few days, he was really patient and loving and attentive. And the family just really enjoyed being together again. And one night, the four of them were outside of the cabin. I imagine them like sitting around a bonfire or, you know, drinking like hot cocoa and chatting. And they have some dogs and the dogs keep running back and forth barking at the trees.
Them dogs are barking.
The dogs are barking.
But really actually barking.
Literally barking and okay. Will not stop.
Okay.
And remember, they're on a huge piece of land, so they're not really bothering anyone. But Charles starts to like try to shut it down. He tries to be like, stop, you know, like quiet, get inside, whatever. But the dogs aren't. And Pam says this is weird because normally like Charles had the kind of personality where he'd be like, let's hop in the truck and go see what they're barking at. Like, this is funny. Like, let's go.
Right.
So it's not like he was doing it to spare anybody else. And it wasn't like him to not be curious about what was happening.
But instead, he's like, don't draw attention to us.
Yeah. And as they're out there, and I don't know if you guys know what it's like to have an animal that will not leave something alone. The thing that I always think about is like if you're ever riding a horse and they really want a fucking snack and they just will not lift their head up from the damn ground. You're like, come on, let's go. And they're like, but one more leaf. That's what it reminds me of because they just won't leave it be. And I don't know if they ever found out what was in the woods, but very shortly after this, like a random stranger came up the driveway and they started talking to Charles and they were kind of like, hey, sorry to bother you, but are there any homes or land for sale in the area?
Okay.
Yeah, man. We're on 160 acres. The next spot over is like an hour that way. I don't know if it's an hour, but you know what I mean? Like it's a hike up the drive here. How the fuck did you find us?
And also, like, sorry to bother you, but do you know if somebody else is selling land around here? Yeah. I understand it's not you.
Are you by chance a real estate worker?
Yeah, it sounds like this guy's a plant. I don't trust him.
Yeah.
He's an undercover or something. He's like, oh, I was just in the neighborhood. It's like, how did you yeah, wander up? Yeah,
what neighborhood? What There's did you a wander mercantile upon? And a restaurant.
Like, what brought you here? Did you see the smoke from my fire and you thought, let's make friends? What are you doing?
Yeah. And that's what I think it probably had to be because Charles himself seemed really weary and like he didn't want to engage with the man. And normally he's known as, you know, a pretty friendly guy. He might not be like warm and fuzzy, but he'll talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty odd that he was wary in general. And again, like, I don't know if they ever found out what was in the woods, but to me, it's mighty suspicious that your dogs won't leave something alone in a tree line. And then a stranger comes up the driveway.
Mm.
Like that to me says I'm watching and then I'm going to retreat and come up.
Yep.
But either way, when the guy left, all four of them went inside and The next morning, Charles tried to wake Pam up and he's like, good morning. Like, good morning, sunshine. The earth says hello. Mm. And she sort of gets up and he says, you know, I love you, right? Always remember that I love you.
Uh-oh.
And this struck Pam as weird because, again, he might be a, you know, kind of a teddy bear in that, like, he gives a good hug when he gives a hug, but he's not doing it often.
Right.
And he's sure as shit not saying I love you unless it's, like, a big deal. Like, he wants that to pack a punch. And so she said she knew in the moment that it meant something, but she didn't know what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
But she thinks he knew from the night before that that day was going to be weird.
Okay.
So Debbie makes breakfast, and when breakfast is ready, the phone rings, and Charles answers, and he seems kind of nervous. The phone call's like a couple of seconds max, like no more than a minute, and he's answering in short, like one-word answers.
Mm-hmm.
And then he basically just says, be right back, and hoofs it. He like takes off.
Okay.
Which is strange.
I have to say,
mm-hmm.
if you're the kid and dad just said that, like, you know, I love you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is odd, and he's never done that. And then he answers the phone, and then you see him, like, run.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the man I'm picturing here doesn't run.
Yeah.
So when you see that man run, you...
I'm thinking I better be running, too.
You might want to run, like, something is wrong. You ever see that? Like,
yeah.
There are some dads that, like, you've never seen run in your life. I don't know if they know how.
Yeah.
This man... The way he is described, 6'4", 260,
yep.
gruff with like beard sometimes and everything like that. Like, if he's running, you should also probably get running because it takes a lot to get him to do that.
Yep, exactly. No, exactly. And then imagine it's like first thing in the morning.
Hell no.
So just odd. And this is on August 13th. He hadn't even been home for 2 weeks, which... Just, I don't know. It's a lot for me to think about from the kid's perspective to be like, dad was just gone for 3 months. He's home for less than 2 weeks and now he's sprinting out the door.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other end of the phone, what we know is that police said they had papers on an unrelated matter that they needed to serve him and that he's getting sued. So they need him to come down to the only mercantile in Kenny Lake mm-hmm. to be served.
I don't think I'd be that eager to go get sued either, but that's me.
Well, it's interesting to me because they obviously are like following him from afar out mm-hmm. of the house.
But they need to lure him away.
Right. They don't want a hostage situation. They don't want him to have access to all of his firearms and, you know, for things yep. to get messy that way. But what's curious to me is like I heard that and initially I was like, okay, so he's running from the police. Like he knows the police are in town and he wants to get the hell out of Dodge.
Right.
But he literally runs to the mercantile. Like he goes there.
Yeah, where they agreed to meet.
Right. Which is just interesting to me. He's like, okay, better hurry up and get served so I can get back to my oatmeal.
Maybe he doesn't want people looking into him too long. So he's like, all right, let me square this away. Like, I'll deal with this. But I just want to go get my paperwork and leave so that they're not looking for me and snooping around.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be it.
I have no idea. But he goes and he is arrested without incident while he's there.
Okay.
Now, back at the cabin, the rest of the family is eating. And like mid-breakfast, the SWAT team breaks in.
Oh, man.
And now... I think it's probably good that Charles wasn't arrested in front of his family.
Mm-hmm.
That seems nice. But it's not necessarily better to then hold his family at gunpoint while he's not there.
I mean, as far as they know, though, because they're literally camped out in the woods, they're like a mini cult.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll go down with the ship.
So it's not even long before Charles is arrested that the FBI learns that Larry Ulrich is Charles Weir, is Charles Sinclair, and that all of these different aliases are him.
Mm-hmm.
So this is happening pretty much in real time. But the whole family is now separated and questioned. Pam says that it was really upsetting to her because one of the SWAT guys was pointing a gun at her and she was like, but I didn't even do anything wrong.
Aww.
And he had asked their name and, you know, she's been conditioned now for what, like at least a third of her life to say that her name is Pam Weir. So that's what she tells them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, no, what's your dad's name? And she said, J.C. Weir. And the investigators are like, okay, no, we know your name is Sinclair. And she thinks it's still related to the shop burning down.
Oh, so she's all worried, like she's going to be the one to say something that gets dad taken away.
Yeah.
Oh, baby, daddy did that all on his own.
Yeah, he really did, like a lot of times on his own.
Oh, my God.
And so they, you know, separate the family. They question them. Police search the cabin. They find guns and a travel bag from his stuff when he went down south. They also found a golden watch that's engraved from the Billings shop. And Michael was wearing a Rolex that was stolen from Legacy Rare Coins.
Oh.
I feel bad for Michael because I feel like they're like, give me your watch. And he's like, but that's for my dad.
He's like, this is the only thing dad's ever given me.
Yeah.
I got like a baseball card one time and this. Please don't take it.
And they're like, no, this is stolen. You're like, he couldn't even get me a gift?
No.
Anyway. So.
Some people.
Eventually, they tell the family that he's being arrested on the account of two murders, which would be the owner and the secretary from the Treasure State Silver and Gold store.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, I'm assuming he was also on the hook for the attempted murder of Kelly Flanagan.
Ugh.
But initially, Pam was like, I thought that this had to be like mistaken identity. Like it was not clicking that this could be my dad.
Mm.
But Charles and Debbie both say that Debbie had no knowledge of what was happening.
Okay.
Seems like a mighty bold statement to say absolutely none whatsoever, but that's what they both say.
Mm-hmm.
And Debbie says she just knew he left and came home with money and she didn't ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did have a store, it was a coin store. So like, hey, why not just do it on the road?
Mm-hmm.
Which like is probably a fine excuse for a while. But then why are we moving to middle of nowhere, Alaska? And why do you keep coming home with different facial hair?
Mm-hmm. And different amounts of money.
Yeah.
Huh.
So it was a long time before the family was told that he was linked to over 10.
Ooh.
Now, Charles is charged with two first-degree murders for the Montana murders, and then, of course, the attempted murder in Utah. But since he has been connected to the 10, they just didn't have enough evidence at the time to charge him. Like, they're still learning that he has all these aliases and
right.
that he's all of these people. So they didn't have him on any of those yet. There was either not enough time to collect evidence, no bodies, or not enough, you know, DNA or blood to connect back to him.
Mm-hmm.
And like in the Linton case, they didn't have any bodies, but they did find out that that third unidentified blood type matched Charles.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the investigator on the Linton case believes that Charles could also be responsible for three other crimes that don't often make it on the connected list. And I want to give just like a really quick overview of them. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them because we don't have enough to say that this is for sure. And I'm a little bit hesitant to say that I believe this is the case.
Mm-hmm.
So the first is the kidnapping and murder of another vacationing couple. This is a Canadian couple. And they found them both obviously murdered, but they found the wife sexually assaulted.
That does not sound like his MO.
No, they're, you know, again, it's not impossible that he's had other victims of other crimes while he escalated, but nowhere else is there a sexual assault in his history. And normally that's something that you see repeated
mm-hmm.
pretty frequently.
Yeah.
If people are doing that in their crimes. So I'm pretty hesitant. I'm kind of doubtful of this. And the only way that I believe the next one that they think he's connected to would be if he did that one.
Mm-hmm.
So the next one that the investigator thinks he's connected to is a woman who was a real estate agent who was raped in the same month that the Lintons were killed.
Okay.
And I don't know. I don't know. That's all I have. But he does think that sometimes these are included in the connected list and sometimes they're not.
Okay.
But Charles spent 77 days in Palmer Jail in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm pretty sure it was Anchorage.
Okay. 77, not enough.
77 is not enough. And you might be saying, okay, well, you said jail. Maybe that's because he got transferred to a prison.
Yeah.
He, in fact, got transferred to hell because he just died about 2 months after.
Oh.
He
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry for how I said that.
Not
that
much of a lateral move, more of a
downward move. Yeah, it was definitely downward mobility for him.
If you know what I mean.
But he did. He died of an overdose of blood pressure medication.
Oh, okay.
And that's kind of hard to do. It's really interesting. Some people think it's accidental. Some people think it was suicide. And some people think that somebody else was behind it entirely. So basically, Charles went into jail with 3 prescriptions. He had 2 narcotics for pain and the blood pressure. And the jail was like, fuck your narcotics. Mm-hmm. My words, not theirs. They said, you don't get those anymore.
Yep.
And then they essentially halved his blood pressure medication. Mm-hmm. Now, again, they have like medical staff there.
Yeah, they have doctors and everything. They
clearly must have had reason to believe he didn't need his whole dose of blood pressure medication.
Maybe he needed all the blood pressure medication from all the narcotics he's taking.
All the narcotics, or I don't know, all of the paranoia from murdering people and watching your back the whole time.
Yep.
But he complains and complains. He was on 80 milligrams, got put down to 40, and then he got boosted back up to 80 after enough days of him being like, this isn't feeling right. This isn't okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very shortly after that he had overdosed. But the thing is, to like overdose on blood pressure medication, he would have had to take a significantly larger amount than like 80 milligrams.
Yep.
So the people who believe that it was a suicide by overdose believe that he was probably just stockpiling them and took them all at the same time. But there are 2 other theories that go around. One is that like a cellmate did it, okay. Which, not for nothing, he sounds like a charming guy to people who don't know him. He doesn't have any like stereotypical red flags or targets that get on people's back when they go into jail.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like he was walking in there with a laundry list of crimes against children that would make other people sort of have a hit out for him.
Right.
And 77 days doesn't sound like enough for him to really piss off a bunkie enough for that. So I don't really know. And then the other camp is that like maybe one of the nurses did it, but that seems like a lot to put on a nurse.
It also could have just been that he wanted to do that. And so he.
Yeah.
Just kept, you know, like, oh, I took my meds and then hid them and then waited till he had enough and then took it. Like, to me, I'm going with camp number one. I'm going with he did it because it's hard to believe that that would be any other thing. I don't think a nurse poisoned him.
No. And I think the only reason that people sort of think of that is like someone else who had access to the sheer amount of blood pressure medication it would have taken. But even still, it sounds like it's all pills and tabs. It's not like he's getting injections for blood pressure meds. So even if somebody else was behind it, they'd have to like, I don't know, gun to head, like take all these pills.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I think it was probably him. My guess is he sounds like a man with a lot of pride. And probably didn't want to have to go down for the things that he did.
Mm-hmm.
That being,
he took the way out of not having to serve the time. Cause I mean, I'm guessing what, 40s, 50s at this point, 40s. So
yeah,
he has a lot of life to live, and that's a lot of life to live behind bars. And you know, you're getting forever.
Yep.
So he could have looked at that and said, hell no. And maybe he saw this as his only chance to do it. Because if he was like in a high security prison or something, they're gonna have that locked down. It's gonna be very difficult to be able to do anything that you'd like to do, especially not that.
Yeah, especially anything that involves like controlled substances, even if that controlled substance is a blood pressure med.
I mean, they're kind of controlled.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I mean, hell, in a high max security prison, even like ramen is a controlled substance. But like,
basically.
So just very interesting. I will say before that happened, he did write his family a really nice letter. I think maybe a few, but definitely one that Pam talks about where he writes in there that he and Debbie love Pam more than anything in the world and how much she means to them. And I know that that is important to her. It was really touching and just sort of heartbreaking to see Pam struggling so much with someone she knew as like a loving dad being capable of all of this. And I think that is really part of what draws me to this case is like this man truly, it wasn't an inability to keep interpersonal relationships. It wasn't out of a need because he couldn't emotionally ground himself or regulate himself. It was truly just for money.
Mm-hmm.
It was all transactional. And so Pam talks a lot about like struggling with the idea that he thought other people's lives were so disposable that they were to just fund theirs.
Yeah.
And it's true. It's so just kind of mind boggling to me that you can turn it on and off like that so fast.
I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But what always gets me in these kinds of cases is seeing somebody work so hard at not working hard.
Yeah.
Like all of the time, effort, planning, stress. Like Abby is sitting before me with an ulcer.
Yeah.
This man didn't have it. Like, how no. do you have an ulcer? Not him, but regardless. But like the stress of that and like reasonable stress, warranted stress. You should absolutely be stressed about murdering people and getting like, of course. But where you could have just worked.
Yeah.
And I believe he burned his place down. Now, I know we can't like prove that or anything. And there was no investigation leading like them to that answer. But what I know, I don't trust his
right.
morals. But at the same time, like, I just, I struggle with that because the family just probably would have wanted him there. Like, work a normal job.
Well,
it doesn't have to be glamorous. It just has to be something.
And not for nothing, but any job he could have worked where he just literally, even if he went in, put his 40 hours in, didn't think about it twice the second he clocked out and went home to his family, I'm pretty sure it would have gotten him more than a dry cabin in the middle of Alaska. Not that that's not good. It's just like maybe the housing quality could have been a little bit better.
But you had to go on the run and hide out in a place you didn't think anybody would find you. Like, that's why you're there.
Right. And also, his family, even after learning all of this, seems like they would have wanted him around for another 50 years after that, regardless of what that life looked like. So by doing this, he's essentially stealing that time from his family with him. And it sounded like he cared about his family. Like, he was a family guy. He wanted to be around them. But then, like, do the right thing. Don't harm people for your gain. But, like, think about the people that you're saying you're putting first. If you were really putting them first, like, what's best for your kids isn't a dad in prison.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a life where they can't have any long-term connections. It's not cutting them off from their grandparents and telling them that their grandparents just aren't writing them back.
Exactly. Like, when we talk about the victims in each case and, like, just how far-reaching it is, I feel like his victim count is a lot higher than you'd think at first because, of course, it's those 10 to 13-ish people.
Yeah.
That he's, you know, 10 that we know, a few more, and I think probably some beforehand.
Oh, yeah.
So let's call it 15.
Yeah.
Let's say that the 15 people that he murdered and their families and their loved ones and their friends and colleagues that loved them, they've been victimized by him. But then also his family, who has been ripped away from everything they know. I don't know how I feel about Debbie. I'll talk about her in a bit.
Yeah.
But like, those kids never got to make friendships that could be lasting, that had to change their name and kind of live under like a fake pseudonym and like a little alias and then just think, well, if anybody knows, it's like it's us against them. Like, their kids by definition will get some of that like paranoia transferred to them.
Yeah.
And then they lost the time with their other loved ones, so like they're victimized. Like I said last week, like I'd give anything to have another day with my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
He just took years of his children's and their grandparents' time that they could have had, and that is time that is not, it's fleeting.
Yep.
You know, and you always wish you had more, and you just stole that from everybody so that you could take other people's lives to do. Like, was this the life that you wanted? Dude, like, did you want to end up on 170 acres where you have to worry every time the dog barks, not because of an animal, but because they might be onto you?
Yeah. Well, and it's also just so frustrating that, you know, he did not serve nearly enough time. There was really no justice here. He spent 77 days. He never admitted to anything that is connected to him. He was never formally convicted of anything. And the only surviving victim he had, Kelly, said that he felt cheated by Charles' death. Like, mm-hmm. there is truly no, I mean, there's closure here, but there's no good justice. And it's like, I don't know what you can do for the secondary victims in this case and Kelly, who's the only surviving like primary victim. But I feel like there's got to be something. And I don't believe that Debbie didn't know anything. I mean, like, thinking about it, thinking through all of the options, the best case, like the best case scenario is that she's just like a little bit dumb. Not like she's a dumb person, but just like best case is she just like is oblivious.
Best case, she a dumb bitch. I didn't say that. I know you didn't, but I mean, best case scenario, yes, I think aloof. And I think that she maybe had a gut feeling and was like, nope, focus on the task at hand, and very like, ignorance is bliss, kind of what I don't know.
Stick your head in the sand and don't ask questions.
Yes. And I can look at her in a couple of different ways, because I think on one hand, there's that piece of like, how the hell did you not put this together? He's disappearing. He comes back. He looks different. All of a sudden, there's large sums of money. He doesn't have to work. You don't have to work.
Yeah.
You can't talk to anybody. You can't use your own name. Like, the red flags are neon at this point. Where I'm like, you've got kids to worry about. But then at the same time, she does have kids to worry about.
Right.
So what did that mean for them? And were they in danger? And what was the best way to mitigate that? And then also, she's cut off from her family, her friends. She doesn't have a sounding board or anybody else like reasonable to run this by and be like, does this, like, this is weird, right? Or this is off, right? She's probably not, like, they're in Alaska. They're not watching TV. Like, they can't. Yeah. I'm not saying people in Alaska don't have TV, but where they are in Alaska,
they don't.
They don't have anything. They're not seeing the news. She's not seeing like coin shop murders. Like, she's not seeing these things for at least part of the time.
Exactly. And like, I think about her, and best case is she just didn't know. She just was not existing on this plane. And then there's these sort of overlapped layers of like, maybe she did know and she didn't really want to know. Like, cognitive dissonance is a hell of a drug. I married this man. I don't want him to be a bad man. I'm not going to look for any signs that he's a bad man.
I chose to have children with this man. I don't want my children's father to be a bad person. I don't want my kids to see their dad as a bad person. So I'm going to maintain this front-facing, like, confidence in him toward that, like, toward to the kids.
And then, and that might not even be a conscious level thing. That might just be happening in the way back of her brain where she's too afraid to open the lid to that jar. Mm-hmm. But, like, then there's also this moment I have of thinking about that being where she starts and having this almost quote-unquote, like, lucid moment of, like, holy shit, like, this really might not be good.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do you do with that as a person and a mother? Like, I want to stay safe. I want to keep my kids safe. He clearly has a good relationship with them. Like, he's with them 99% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they all seem to enjoy each other. Like, there's no accounts of him being a bad father except for all of the murder. Like, he wants to be there with them. He'll interact with his kids. He has good times and talks with them. So, like, do you want to then sort of tear apart that attachment and that relationship? And also, he's the one that's been working. So what are you going to do if something happens? Like, and that's if you're okay if something happens. Because if you're recognizing that something bad is going on here, you're recognizing that he's capable of something bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel for her. And at the same time, I definitely don't think she knew nothing. I don't trust that anybody can really be that.
I wouldn't want to switch spots with
painfully
her.
Aloof.
Yeah. I don't want to be her. I struggle that she knew nothing. I feel like there's just too many red flags. I understand not having an outlet, and I give her like a little bit of a pass on that of like not being able to bounce ideas. But like, you know what? You have kids. It's not about you. It isn't just about you. It is also about their well-being. It is also about their safety. And they are probably like, Mom, why do we have to move like every 6 months?
Right.
Not just neighborhoods, but entire states for probably a reason, like they're not being told.
Right.
Like, this is for the adults, or don't worry about it, or like, we'll tell you later, or something like that. It's just odd. And then like, they're in the middle of nowhere. It doesn't seem like they're leaving. So are these kids even in school? Like, at what point is the mother going to be like, all right, but this is negatively impacting my kids. I need to know what's going on.
Right.
Well, and that's where I kind of struggle. It's not blaming her, because I don't really know what she could do. Like, she doesn't know that he's killing people. Maybe. If she did, it's absolutely on her to say something, but doesn't sound like she
right
knew. She knew something was up, didn't know what that something was. So then, like, what is she going to do? Go contact the police and be like, my husband leaves for a little bit and then he comes back.
Right. And they're still probably going to be like, okay, well, that's a matter of the home.
Like, that's so a, we're not that seems like a domestic.
That's domestic the 80s issue. And 90s mentality on that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So it's just, I feel for her, but I don't hold her entirely out of responsibility on this.
Nope. I feel like there are things that you could and should have picked up on, but I also can't be like, well, this is exactly how you must have felt in this moment, because I don't know.
Right.
But.
Well, and it's also possible that she just really, my guess is, like, zeroed in on the kids. Like, this is what's in front of me. This is what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that. But what a wild case. I feel for those kids. I feel for the victims and all of this. It's so senseless.
It is. And there's something really terrifying about a guy that could walk into a place, make friends with you. Professional mm-hmm. friends. Like, he's talking the talk and walking the walk, but he's trying to build connections and a rapport so that they don't get skeeved when he walks in again.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That allow him some kind of closeness to then kill them. And he's doing this like several times a year.
Yeah.
So like he has this ability to callously manipulate people and then kill them just to take their things. Like it's just, Ted Bundy was terrifying too.
Yep.
In that he could be social and he looked normal. You expect him to be a goblin for what he did and he's not. Yep. But like his need to kill was like pathological and his, you know what I mean? Like he needed to and whatever. And it was violent and terrifying. And like his eyes changed, right? They said like his eyes seemed to go black. He looked different. He acted different, whatever. There's something equally terrifying about someone who can just walk in, look you straight in the face, after having talked to you for a few days, to just kill you over your stuff.
Well, and not for nothing, but I think about Kelly's experience and the idea of, and I know this is minor in comparison to like the multiple things that he has been connected to, like murder and robbery are giant. But the idea to me that you are about to go do that, you're doing it with seemingly all of your wits about you. Like it's not a rage killing. It's not like he's getting dysregulated and lashing out. Like mm-hmm. he is planning this, executing, taking stuff and leaving so that he can go home to his family and not work. That's it. But the fact that he's going to do that and then call you a bastard under his breath for, like, what? Trusting him?
Yeah, like, idiot.
Yeah, like, stupid.
And then you shoot the man in the back. Like, you wait till he turns around.
Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know. There's something very terrifying about that, too. And I don't know. He looks the part of, like, the rural dad, but he's not. There's something
going on. And, like, I feel for the kids. Pam says just essentially how much she struggles with being the product of someone who could do something so vile.
And the other half of you is the part that didn't notice.
Right. But
I imagine you're very critical of yourself and you struggled self-esteem wise and everything. Like I can imagine her thinking of it that way. And it has nothing to do with her. No. And it's not her fault. And her mom wasn't the one killing anybody.
No. And also not for nothing. Like there are a lot of things that are genetic, but as far as I know, that's not one of them. And I like to look at that stuff, you know, not. I like to research sort of the genetic pieces of a lot of mental health, because a lot of that tells you about like neuroscience and the brain. And as far as I know, there's nobody that's like teamed up with their parents or like learned from mom or dad on how to do something so vile. So it's definitely not something that she's inheriting. And the fact that she's critical of that and worried about that says so much more to me than the DNA she came from.
I feel for her.
And I feel for Michael. As far as I know, he's stayed like really out of the news, sort of like not really talked much on it. And I'm trying to give him that privacy because that's his right. But
yeah,
man, I hope they're doing okay. I hope Kelly's doing well.
Yeah.
But that was the Quintrop killer. I can't believe I'd never heard of him before.
No, I mean, I just if you have a feeling about somebody, you have a feeling. Like that brings me back to the guy in was it Utah that was like, you don't have farmer's hands from Texas.
Yeah.
you know, when you notice those things, trust those things. That is built on like thousands of years of, you know, our brains being developed over time and
our instincts to keep us alive.
Yeah. So if you've got that gut feeling, just note it.
Yeah. Trust your gut. And if it's burning or in pain, it might be an ulcer. And then still trust it and get it looked at because it might be an ulcer, you know?
Just from a friend. I heard that once.
Yeah. Yeah. Asking for a friend. So what a crazy time. If you did want to see the people, the places, the things, you could do that on our Instagram. You could also, while you're there, check out our little meme page, our resources. If you wanted to talk to anybody or look into any of that after today's episode, you could also find our pod pets, send us pictures of yours, send case recommendations or requests, drop us a cute little follow or a review. We would love a 5-star review. I'm just saying.
We're biased, but we think you should do that.
I mean, I think it's 5 stars, but that's fine. And also, I would love to hear from you in our email, which is also in our link tree below. And of course, if you wanted to donate a cup of coffee to the pod or donate fiscally, you could do that at our PayPal or our Venmo linked in the link tree as well. And this is the last spiel. You could get some merch on Redbubble if you are interested, which is also in that link tree. But other than that, I hope you guys have a great week. We are excited to come back at you with one from Allie next week. But in the meantime, if I look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye. Oh my God.